Contest of Champions Live, episode number 50.
Let's get ready to rumble!
All right, welcome back, comic book fans of all sizes and ages. Well, probably not all ages, considering Dirty Daniel frequents the show. In fact, in keeping with the theme of rebooting this show, let's begin with a little disclaimer. And I think we're going to call it the Dirty Dan disclaimer, or the Triple D. As the show evolves week to week, we can adjust the Triple D to suit the level of degradation that Dan or anybody else might bring to the show.
This week, fuck you.
And there it is, folks.
Jeez. Oh,
we need a delay on this show.
That's good.
This week's Triple D, this episode, I didn't get the disclaimer out in time. Dan was already all over it.
Got up.
This week's Triple D, this episode of the COC may contain adult innuendo and is not suited for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. So there we go. Now that we got that out of the way, we can continue with the show.
Well, welcome back, friends, to a brand new season of the COC. This is season 3 of our live version of the show and our 50th episode, officially, and the 8th time we've come together as the Contest of Champions. What is Contest of Champions, you may ask? Well, gather around, young ones, as Father Jeff tells you about the origin of the origin story of the Contest of Champions. It all began on a beautiful autumn evening, and two incredibly handsome comic enthusiasts.
And Ian.
Hey, that's nice, thanks. The Clobbering Clergyman, that's me, Jeff Jackson, and the Canadian Cape Killer, started asking questions about which superhero could beat up which superhero in a fight. So using our own encyclopedic knowledge of all things comic books and previous fights and breaking down power scientifically, and the two of us, with the help of our small online community, voted on a winner, and the game continued to grow in success over the years, and it evolved, and eventually we decided to move it to a podcast where we were able to discuss the merits of each character live. And so this season we decided to approach the show a little differently. With all the reboots, the New 52s, and the Marvel Nows, and everything in the world of comics, we were feeling a little bit left out. So here it is. It's the new COC Now Live 3.
Or here we go. So what can you expect this season, you ask? Well, like always, you're going to hear us debate superhero fights. Some of the fights we discuss will be based on battles that we see in the actual comic book, sometimes from the past, sometimes from the present. Other fights will be purely just to satisfy our nerd needs. So, for instance, who wins a fight between the Invisible Woman and Storm, say, for instance?
Storm.
Eli?
Invisible Woman.
There we go. So, discussing superhero fights, however, is the obvious part of what we bring to the online world of podcasting. It's what we're world-renowned for. The area that we're hoping to expand on a little bit this year revolves around comic book buzz. Creative teams, story arcs, sinking and rising books, they'll all be fair game on this show from here on in. We hope everyone likes what a merry band of misfits like us has to say and what we have to offer to the comic book community. So feel free to contact us. Let us know what you think. We probably won't care what you have to say, but we'd love to hear it anyway. Or even better, tell us what you would like to hear us discuss. Now, we don't get a lot of feedback on the show in terms of what we should discuss on the show, and I think that's because the show is pretty close to perfect.
That's true. There's not much really to really change. But we want to welcome the fabulous cast of the Contest of Champions. First of all, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Tom McNeely. How you doing, Tom?
Doing well. How's everybody doing tonight?
Good. And the aforementioned Dirty Dan, Pervy Dan, the Spider-Man geek, Mr. Dan Brienne. How are you, Dan?
Hello.
And last but not least is the
the ambiguous.
The beautiful, the lovely Mrs. Ellie Anthony. How you doing?
Do we have a female guest? I wasn't aware of that. But Eli Anthony's doing great.
Okay,
great.
Very good.
I was happy to be here.
I know, it's like I came on the show tonight for this. So anyway, we're glad to have you guys with us again. First up is a new little portion to our show that we're going to call our highs and low points of the week. And so what we're going to do is in this section we're going to discuss our favorite and least favorite moments from this week's comics. And Ian and I are going to kind of kick this off for this first episode, and you guys can toss in some thoughts as we go along. And in our next couple episodes, we'll be sure to get your feedback and your highs and lows as well. So hold on to your hats, folks, because no one is safe in the highs and lows. So, Ian, why don't you kick us off there, pal?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, too, we weren't exactly sure how many people were going to be on tonight, so Jeff and myself filled the highs and lows. But like Jeff said, in the upcoming episodes, what we'll do is Jeff and myself will just pick one high and one low, and then we'll get all the other guests on the show to pick a high and low as well, so that we can all get our fair share in. We don't want to feel like we don't want to monopolize the show, right? One of the things I think that Jeff and myself were going for with this new format was we really enjoyed the back and forth and the actual comic talk that we've had in the past seasons, and I think we're trying to kind of pump that up a bit, get more of that, hey Jeff?
Pump up the volume, pump up the volume, pump up the volume, dance, dance. Yes.
Ouch.
All right.
Wow.
Yeah, you guys are embarrassing me.
Give us your high, man.
Okay, so now, Jeff, do you want me to go through all three of my highs, or want to go back and forth one and one? What do you want to do here?
Let's start with our number threes and work our ways to our number ones. That's fine.
Okay. So my number three high of the week is from Boom Studios. I've been surprised by this title. Boom Studios, they've really kept me entertained with Fanboys vs. Zombies series. Now, the series is not for everyone, that's for sure. It's not to be taken very seriously, that's for sure. But it's a great, I think, homage to zombie pop culture and just pop culture in general. So, like, for instance, this week's cover was a great homage to Back to the Future. So the font was done in the Back to the Future font, and they're all dressed up in their Back to the Future get-ups and stuff like that. And it's constantly referencing pop culture. In the book, in this issue, number nine was this week, a character is introduced where they find this comic book writer during the zombie apocalypse. And it's supposed to be Robert Kirkman is who the writer is, but they slightly change his name. But the drawing of him, it's Kirkman. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's actually Kirkman. And they pull no punches. I love it. I love this series. It makes me laugh.
I do not read that. My number three high of the week would be Wolverine number 317, the end of this series, I guess, of Wolverine, written by Cullen Bunn, art by Paul Pelletier. And it's just, the story is okay. I mean, it's not bad. They've been kind of doing this thing with this group that Cullen Bunn has created called the Covenant, which is an old team of just kind of random people that have been pulled together, and they do these missions and things like that. And so, and then they had a big blow up. But one person on the team is like a vigilante, and one is a detective, and one is a mad scientist, and they pull all these different people together, and back in the day they hired Wolverine to kill this woman named the Dreaming Maiden, and because she was really dangerous, but Wolverine had a heart and had sex with her or something, and then decided to save her. And anyway, it's just really, really it's a good ending to the series. But the real thing is Paul Pelletier is, I mean, he's just one of my favorite artists. He's so good. He's got an Alan Davis style, but I think he's a little grittier. He's a little more graphic. He's not afraid to draw some really kind of visceral things. and he's just so good. But the real highlight of this issue is him drawing Wolverine in Wolverine's original Whiskers costume.
Yeah,
I loved it. Oh, I just loved it. That was great.
Yeah, that was a nice touch for sure. Number two for me is and actually I was surprised by this series because I was going through some websites today and I think it was CBR. I could be wrong though. And they published their 10 biggest disappointments of the year, and they put this on their list, and for me it's one of my highs for this week. And that's Before Watchmen. I've really enjoyed almost all of the Before Watchmen books. I can't say all of them, but almost all of the Before Watchmen books. They keep me entertained week after week. I love them. And this week it was Rorschach number 3. And yeah, it was just great.
Not reading that one either.
I thought they've been doing a good job with the Before Watchmen books.
Yeah,
they've been so beneficial to the original series. Like, basically for me, what they've done is they've made or remade that original graphic novel relevant again. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. And they haven't tried to depart from the material. They keep trying to hook everything back into the original series. So they aren't trying to retcon anything or make anything happen that wouldn't logically happen in the original series. So that's really, yeah, they've done a great job of trying to make it a true prequel and not trying to feed in new storylines and everything that either, you know, everything in there has either been referred to in the graphic novel or has been or hinted at. And
Tom, which one's your favorite so far? Which series?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
For me, it's for sure Minutemen. I love that book.
Yeah, Minuteman's been really good. I also liked Rorschach. Has been really good too. Ozymandias isn't bad either.
Oh yeah, the art's beautiful.
Yeah,
Jason Lee.
Yeah,
cool. My number two high is The Walking Dead number 105. I'm loving this Carl-centric story. Carl wandering off on his own, but trying to go and take out the new big bad for The Walking Dead, and he's screwing up all of Rick's plans and all this. It's just great. And this guy Negan is a psychopath. I mean, he's sick, and you know, sure, there's going to be lots of comparisons to the governor, and you know, Kirkman just trying to kind of top the governor, I think he's doing a pretty good job of making this guy a little bit crazier. So I'm enjoying the hell out of it. So
yeah, I won't say anything about that one because it's in my low list. So
yeah, I know. Yeah.
Yeah, and my number one high, which was very very unexpected for me, was Avengers Arena number 1. I had no intention of picking this book up whatsoever. I dropped Avengers Academy a long time ago. Actually, Avengers Academy is one of those books I dropped like 6 times. You know what I mean? And then I'd buy it again because, you know, some ex people would show up on the cover or something like that. And then I'd be like, okay, what the hell did I just do? And I'd drop it again. And it just absolute garbage, that book. And, you know, in the whiny teen bullshit crap plights, it just bothered me so much. So then I picked up this book, and the only reason I picked up this book was I went to the store, leafed through it, and then saw Arcade, who I knew was the villain in it, but I saw the way that he was drawn, and he just had this, you know, it's not the Arcade that we remember, you know, the little bow tie, redheaded, geeky guy. He has this, I don't know, more contemporary, dangerous look to him, and I thought, oh, I'm going to give this a shot, just because I saw Arcade, and then I read it, and it was good. It was really good. And it even had some of that stupid teen drama stuff in it. But Dennis Hopeless did a nice job of writing it. And the last page was awesome. I hope they stick to that. I know they won't, right? I know they'll revamp that somehow or something, retcon that somehow. But I wish they wouldn't. I wish they would stick to that. That would be a great. Hopeless would have me if he stuck to that.
Well, if he sticks to this whole status quo, which is, you know, all of these kids are on this island and they're going to be the only one is going to walk away alive. Like, please let that be true. I mean, even though there's a lot of characters on this that I really love and some of that I don't really care to see killed, Please let it be really true that only one will walk away. And I just think that would be phenomenal.
Marvel, you listen to us. You always listen to this show. Listen to us.
Yeah.
Person walk away.
Yeah, I loved that book too. I was really impressed. But my number one high of the week is got to be Batman number 15. Holy crap!
Ooh.
This is so good. This is so good. I mean, this is honestly, I'm getting kind of nervous about what will happen after this arc. Because I'm in Batman heaven right now. I love the Joker. I love the way Snyder writes the Joker. I love that he is so completely in the head of Batman and of all the Bat family. Just this whole thing is just great. It's just a perfect Joker Batman story, and I can't wait to see where it's gonna go. And Capullo, God, that guy is just a monster at drawing. I mean, he's so good. Just even like the best part is, you know, Batman like clocks the Joker, and the Joker, you know, he's got this face that's attached to his own face, and it's just like when Batman punches him, it shifts all over on one side, and just little things like that. I think Joker is creepier than he's ever been. This is good stuff. Good stuff.
Yeah.
And let it be known that that my high of the week is a DC book. Okay.
So, and Dave, you reading Batman?
Me? No.
Yeah. You're not?
No. It's
good stuff.
I don't read any DC.
Yeah, I just started my Bat Block this morning, so I haven't gotten to the Death of the Family issues yet from this past month, but I can't wait. The first parts I read last month were really good.
Yeah, I stopped picking up the Batman books. I'd been picking them all up. And I stopped and the actual, you know, core book, the one that you're talking about, Jeff, I didn't mind. I thought it was really good.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you, every time I walk in the comic store and there's like 15 Bat titles in front of me.
Yeah.
I stopped. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, what is going on here?
Well, what's great about this is though, I'm only reading Batman. I don't need to read the other tie-ins or anything like that. It's all very center on this, and one of the things that the other good things about this is that there's kind of a long-standing secret that Bruce has been keeping from the rest of the Bat family about an interaction with the Joker, and it gets revealed here, and so there's all these questions now about, you know, can we trust Bruce? You know, in the midst of this, so it's just really good. So, I would say, you know, wait till the trade comes out, pick this trade up. Yeah, I think it'll be good.
Well, and one of the things too, I should say, that's changed quite a bit from me since when we stopped recording, and then now that we've started back up again, my collecting habits have changed a fair bit. And I hate using the word collecting, so I shouldn't say that. My reading habits have changed a fair bit, and there's no rhyme or reason to why. I've just kind of been angry. And I don't know if I'm angry towards comics or life or, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
Do you need to talk about it there, pal?
Yeah, there's a lot of crappy stuff going on right now in Ontario with, you know, my job and things like that.
Oh,
so
okay.
There's a lot of stuff like that. But so when it, like, all it takes for me now is I walk in there and I see 13 Bat titles on the shelf. And, you know, it takes me 5 seconds longer than normal to locate the one that I want.
Right.
And I'm like, that's it. I'm not collecting this book anymore.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there could be a stinky guy standing in front of my normal books that I collect. And if I don't want to reach around, I've dropped it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know why.
Well, speaking of lows.
All right. So my number three low, starting from the back end, is Dark Avengers. This book has undergone so many transformations. So Dark Avengers, this is the Thunderbolts book, I think.
Well, yeah.
It's hard to tell anymore. Like, they keep changing the title and who's in it and who's not in it. And it's the Dark Avengers book looks a lot like the Dark Avengers book looks a lot like, you know, the Dark Avengers of the past books. And it's an absolute disaster. And I have no idea what the story's about. I can't follow it. It's too complex. It's meaningless. It's everything. They're always jumping through time and stuff like that. And it's just, I don't care about these people. I don't care about their story. It's too bad. So yeah, this book, you'll never hear me talk about this book again, 'cause I'm done with that.
Yeah. My number three low is Fantastic Four number two. After two issues, they finally go to space after they've been talking about it for these two issues. And it's like, okay, can we finally get... I mean, the whole point of the first issue was the setup to, okay, they're going to go into space, they're going to travel around, do all this, they're going to travel through time and space and all this stuff. And like, this issue was just more setup. I mean, it continued on from Fantastic Four number one to FF number one, and then back to this issue. So it's really been three issues that they've just been talking about leaving, and now they finally are leaving. Like, this issue just felt like, okay, how much longer can we drag this out? You know, I'm not typically a huge Fantastic Four fan, but I did like the first issue. I'm going to go through the first arc and just see how it goes. I like the new status quo of Reed discovering that the unstable molecules have turned cancerous, and so he's going into space to kind of figure, or into some alternate universes to find a cure. But the rest of the team doesn't know that yet. They just think they're going on vacation. They're gonna, you know, and so they're leaving another team of Fantastic Four behind to take their place for a little while. And I like that status quo, and I love Mark Bagley. But this issue was just a, okay, all right, finally, let's move on. So,
Jeff, is this case?
So, don't most of the heavy hitters in the Marvel Universe wear unstable molecule uniforms? Like, the X-Men, I know, had.
Well, it's not unstable. It's not their uniforms. It's the fact that, you know, when they were bombarded by the cosmic rays, that the actual molecules that make him stretch, which are unstable, are now turning cancerous.
So it will affect
the other team members as well. It just hasn't yet. So that's the plan, at least, I think. So
I have a question for Tom for this, being, you know, he's such a longtime collector. Tom, would you say that the Fantastic Four, just the idea of the Fantastic Four as like this, you know, this kind of almost like a family unit that's a team, do you think it's still viable today as a book?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. The dynamic's different from a lot of other books, because they're not just teammates, they're also family. And they're so close-knit that it brings I mean, that was the kind of revolutionary thing about them in the first place, is they brought in a human element into a team book. Mm-hmm. Instead of just coming together for an adventure, they wake up one morning and somebody attacks the Baxter Building. You know, it's... Things happen that weren't just team events. Like the previous team books were always told in a kind of an arc format, a multi-part arc format, where you had a opening segment where the whole team met, you know, had their weekly meeting, and then they got intel that something was going on, so they split up into so many different groups, like four different groups, and each one went and had their own individual adventures or partnered up with someone for an adventure, and then finally the last chapter they all come together and beat the bad guy. That was kind of the arc. So there was not really the closeness that was, you know, the Fantastic Four is different in that they, you know, they had as much family, Stanley put as much family humanist type stuff in their, you know, character development as he did adventure stuff.
Right.
So yeah. I think that it's a viable book. It could just be that the characters are getting a little stale, seeing as how they've been doing, they've been basically the same for 50 years.
Right.
And how are Reed and Sue not divorced yet?
Seriously.
Because Sue is that awesome.
Sue is not that awesome. If she was that awesome, she would, she'd leave Reed.
Yeah, she'd leave that piece of crap. Yeah.
No.
Here's the reason.
So we can't have one person that cares about marriage? I mean, come on.
No. Here's the real reason. You know what's keeping them together?
Don't say it, Jeff.
Stretchy,
man. Stretchy penis powers. Stretchy penis powers.
Neymar just couldn't measure up, huh?
She's never going to find that with anybody else. So
I can't remember if it's in one of the movies or if it was in the comic that Sue actually made a comment about that. Or
yeah, probably. All right.
Hey, Jeff, before we move that off from that one,
yeah,
because I don't read this book, what's the deal with the girl who has the body like thing?
Oh, the thing that is so. Each of the four Fantastic Four members were sent to go find a replacement, and the thing that they've told them is that they're, because they're traveling through space and time, they're actually only going to be gone for 4 minutes. But just in case something goes wrong, they've got this backup team. So so Reed picks Scott Lang, Ant-Man. Sue picks Medusa, which is a strange pick because, you know, Medusa is the queen of the Inhumans. But anyway.
Humans remember the Fantastic Four back in the
60s. Yeah, I know. But, I mean, it's a strange pick considering what she's up to now. But anyway. And then the Thing picks She-Hulk. Good pick. And then Johnny Storm picks his new girlfriend, who is this girl. I don't know anything about her other than what's been shown in these couple issues, but I don't know how long they've been dating or whatever. Her name is like Darla Deering or something like that. But I don't know. She hasn't gotten to the point where she's putting on the Thing suit, but supposedly her or at least in this series she hasn't yet. But basically her code name is Miss Thing. It's a little, yeah. Oh, that's wow. Pretty bad. It's pretty bad. Anyways.
What happened to the She Thing they had back in the 90s? Sharon somebody.
Sharon Ventura, the other, what was it? Miss Marvel. She was the other Miss Marvel.
Yeah.
Anyway,
somebody needs to fire someone via email. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. So
definitely.
All right. So my number two low was Jeff's number two high.
Yeah.
And that's The Walking Dead 105. For me, it's everything that Jeff liked about this book, is what I hate about this book. The whole time, all I kept thinking was, okay, settle down there, Kirkman. Like, what's going on there, big boy? He's his language that he's using, like, he's amped up the language.
That's true.
And the stuff that comes out of this Negan guy's mouth, it's like, okay, really? Is that freaking necessary, like, for him to talk like that?
Negan would say, is that fucking necessary?
I'm not a prude or anything, but it's like, this guy's just, I think Kirkman's trying way too hard here. And you know, I disagree with Jeff. I think that what Kirkman's trying to do is, he's looking at his number one villain, which is the governor, and he's trying to top it with this Negan guy.
Yeah.
And he's doing a horrible job. And then the other thing that I hate about it is the part that Jeff loves. Jeff loves that Carl's branching out on his own and it's about Carl. My least favorite character, the character that I wish would have been killed in day one on The Walking Dead, is Carl, right? He's this whiny, stupid little kid who all of a sudden went from being this whiny, stupid little kid to this, you know, dirty, hairy, eye patch wearing, you know, the kid with the beat, you know? And instead, you know, he stows away and Gid's probably listening. He's probably swearing, but you know, this book went from my, you know, when I get my stack, it'd be the first book I read to the last book that I read, because I just don't know if I can stomach the new governor and dirty Carl. Do you know what I mean? Like, good.
Yeah, we'll have to agree to disagree there. My number two low is Age of Apocalypse number 10. Oh, this is just sad. I mean,
It wasn't just me.
It's just so slow. Like, I don't know what it is that they're trying to build to, but it's been an okay series, but it's just like, okay, let's let something happen. And nothing seems to really be happening. And this, you would have thought, like, here you have Sabretooth versus the evil Apocalypse Wolverine, and Jean is kind of caught in the middle. Like, you would think that was kind of a big heavy, but it just felt like, okay, all right. And then
doesn't it essentially take place, that entire fight, off panel?
Yeah, well, there was one kind of cool panel where Wolverine like uppercuts Sabretooth, but I don't know. It just was kind of, it's just like, let's get to the point. And really, this series is just kind of slowly eking down. I mean, you could see they've announced this new extermination arc that's going to cross over between Astonishing X-Men, Age of Apocalypse, and Extreme X-Men, which is just so sad because those are the three worst X books going right now, and it's like, okay, what can we do to kind of boost sales? Oh, let's do a crossover with these, and it's so sad. And then they're like, oh, the only thing that we can do, let's bring a Rick Remender character over from X Force, and maybe that will sell it. I mean, it's so clear that that's what they're doing, just to get some sales. But it's sad.
That book sucks.
Yeah, it does.
Absolutely. My number one low and it's funny because this is also Jeff's number one low, yeah. is Cable and X-Force, which premiered their number one issue. And for me, it's just, you know, it comes down to one simple thing. What, Marvel, what are you doing with Cable? You've taken one of the coolest characters in the X-Verse and in the Marvel Universe, one of the biggest badasses, and gradually over the course of the last, I don't know, like 5 years or so, you've reduced him to this character where they have no freaking clue what they're doing with this guy. So every once in a while he pops up and they throw him in some stupid cockamamie story, and it's ridiculous. You know what I mean? And this is another perfect example of that.
Different this time though, Ian. He's got an eye patch.
and what's his motive here? And I know, you know, they're not gonna reveal that till later, but you gotta kinda give us some kind of clue what's happening here. But no, they don't. You know, he's recruiting people, and once again it's Cable against the Marvel Universe, and only this time he's had Forge create him this big stupid arm that is the stupidest thing I have ever seen in my life. It's got Rob Liefeld written all over it. You know what I mean? Like it is so ridiculous. It's too bad because I bought issue one and that's it. Like there's no way I am buying number two.
Well, you know, as good as Dennis Hopeless did on that Avengers arena, it's amazing. Both of these came out on the same day, both written by him. And this one was just kind of a stinker. I think there has some potential, but here's the other big thing. This book has Forge in it. It has Forge. That's all you need to know. Mm. And there's no reason to. Now, in the Marvel Now .1, there was a little preview deal, like a little short story that kind of led into this. And Hopeless did a great job, I thought, writing Forge, because he made him just whacked out crazy. But it just felt like the regular Forge, and it just lost me. I didn't quite get it. And then throwing in the Uncanny Avengers just because just kind of felt like a cheap ploy. But
well, in Forge, it was the old whiny Forge. You know what I mean? Like, I was surprised that Hopeless didn't have him crying out, you know, Aurora's name in his sleep or something. You know what I mean? Like, it was that whiny, you want to slap him in the face. You know?
Yeah,
exactly. I don't mind the crazy Forge. Like, that's fine. I remember they did the crazy Forge back in the new X-Men days when they brought back Nimrod. Do you remember that?
Right.
And they crashed the plane into Forge's lab and stuff like that.
Right.
That was the awesome crazy Forge. I liked that Forge. You know what I mean? This Forge, yeah, no thanks.
Yeah. Well, anything you guys want to add to the highs and lows?
Yeah, what were your highs and lows of the week?
I was actually just getting to my books today, and something came up, and I didn't get to them. I'm looking forward to the Batman books. I'm glad you didn't spoil anything too badly, Jeff.
No,
and
I didn't.
I was looking Batman forward a little to stop, Stan.
Alfred dies.
Now I'm totally deflated for Cable and X-Force.
Yeah, you should be.
It sucks.
Yeah. Go read it.
With everything you said, Ian. That Cable had so much going. Now it's,
and he's finally free of the techno-organic virus. Like, oh, that's great. And then they slap that stupid ass arm on him. It's like, ugh. Let's actually let him use his telekinesis. Why can't that happen?
Nah, not gonna do that.
Lame. What else? Anything else? You guys?
I had as my low point was the new G.I. Combat. They've got a haunted tank story, and the way they've decided to do it is they've got the pilot of the original haunted tank from World War II. He's now like a 90-year-old man in a nursing home, sitting around in a basically adult diaper and an American flag for a cape, tilting at windmills, and all of a sudden the tank shows up and grabs him, and they teleport off to Afghanistan, rescue his grandson or great-grandson. From some terrorists there, and it's just, you know, you got this guy running around in a, you know, this silly, crazy old man type thing. It's just a, I don't know, kind of a real bastardization of the whole thing. I honestly, I like the Vertigo series better, where they had the weird thing with the it turned out that the descendant of Jeb Stuart, who's in the tank, turned out to be a black man because of some, you know, well, I guess an interracial marriage along the family line. So Jeb appears to him and is like, wait a minute, why am I, you know, you're related to me? That had kind of a funny element to it, but then it also had, you know, being Vertigo is much darker. This one's just, this story of the arc's just been really silly.
So,
anyway, that was my low point. The high point, I read a couple good things. I was kind of liking the Hawkman, Green Arrow, Deathstroke crossover in those three books this past month, where the Thanagarians are trying to capture Hawkman and take him back to Thanagar, and Green Arrow and Deathstroke get sucked into it.
Mm. Exciting.
Yeah.
That does sound exciting.
Dan, how about you?
My low point, I guess, would have to be Amazing Spider-Man 699.1. This really boggled my mind. I'm like, a .1 issue? Really? Before the end of the series? Aren't .1 supposed to be, like, introductory issues for people wanting to jump on?
Well,
like,
it's really Morbius number zero.
Oh, it is, and that brings me to my second problem with it. All it's used for is you're using the Amazing Spider-Man title to yes. launch another shitty title that no one's going to fucking buy.
I like that issue. I thought it was okay.
I thought it sucked. I'm glad to see Raimondi do some work because I miss him off of X-Factor.
Right.
But other than that, I could not care less for Morbius or his story. I don't know. To me, it was lame, and it was lame to use the Amazing Spider-Man title as a launching off point, even though I know that's where he first appeared. So it somewhat makes sense, but being so close, it just totally breaks the tension of what slot's building up to 700. It's like, oh, before we read this last issue, before we get to the big, big finale, take a break and take a look at this living vampire. Like, I just had a major problem with it. So I read it quickly and put it away.
Yeah.
My high point was, I only read two books, so my high point would have been Scarlet Spider, which I'm glad Minimum Carnage is over. It was kind of a shitty story arc. So I'm glad to see that, you know, we can keep going with the life of Kane. Although he's passed out drunk for half the issue, which is somewhat cool, actually.
Nice, yeah.
yeah. Other than that, I mean, it's a pretty interesting read, and seeing the the band of robbers, I guess they're bank robbers, dressed up as Santa Claus with machine guns and sunglasses, reminded me of that Amazing Spider-Man issue that had a Santa Claus with sunglasses on the cover.
Wasn't that a Punisher thing?
No. That was a Spider-Man issue. That Peter David wrote.
Okay.
So I think it was in Peter Parker's Spider-Man. It was pretty controversial when it first came out, and it was basically an homage to the VHS cover of Terminator.
Right.
So it's just Santa Claus with sunglasses holding
yes,
a gun.
Yes. I remember.
So it reminded me of that when I saw this band of robbers. Anyways, I guess in time for Christmas, sure. But it was a fun read. Still continues to be a fun read.
I actually dropped Scarlet Spider because of that Minimum Carnage story. It
sucked. It was horrible. The art was horrible, and the story was throwaway. Who cares about the stupid microverse? Seriously? And as if they went ahead and... I don't know if this was ever established in Fantastic Four, but apparently the microverse holds the entire macroverse, which is like our world, is the glue that holds the entire macroverse together. Which to me is...
I'll be honest, I could do without the microverse as a whole. I mean, I think it's so stupid. And like that Avengers stuff where Wasp came back, oh God, give me a break. Horrible.
Yep.
Yeah, anyway.
Alright. So, from there, let's go on to This Week in Comic News. And actually, did you guys hear about the issue of Amazing Spider-Man that's on eBay, the issues that are on eBay.
Oh, 700. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did hear about that. Yeah,
the big controversy around that and how the guy bought it off some guy in the subway who nobody knows how he got it, and and they put them all on eBay.
Dan actually won the auction. He has it. It's being shipped to his house right now.
How much are they going for on eBay? Do you guys know?
I have no idea.
I think they actually took them down. I think Marvel intervened.
Yeah, probably a cease and desist. Do you think it was legit though, or do you think there was like it was a bit of a scam?
Somebody found an extra cover and stapled it to like an issue of.
No. They talked about it. They talked about how there's a bunch of dealers, like a bunch of comic book shops in New York City that got advanced copies of it, and what happened was a bunch of them, they just didn't take care of their advanced copies, so employees were taking them and stuff like that, and they got out there. They had them like 2 weeks in advance or something like that.
Oh wow.
Yeah, but weren't for 700 though? They were saying that advanced copies hadn't even went out to retailers yet,
except for some of them, obviously.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Supposedly, it's the real deal.
Yeah, because I know somebody had posted scans of some of the pages as well. Mm-hmm. Those got taken down pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's the picture. See the picture? The guy's holding it up, and he's holding the leafing through, and he's giving the finger to the camera the whole time.
No.
You didn't see those.
Wow! Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I think it's like an employee at one of the comic stops or whatever. Anyway, so another interesting thing, and I'll need you guys to jump in here because I was trying to follow it, but it was really hard. Probably because I didn't put enough work into it like I should have, but it was all about this whole Brian Hitch thing with Marvel and the stuff he was saying on Twitter and stuff like that. So I tried to go in a little deeper into what he was talking about, and so I think right now what's happening is Hitch has moved from Marvel to his own creator own stuff, right?
Okay. Let me know.
I think that's what he's doing. I think he's making his move towards more creator own stuff. Now I could be wrong. I could totally be wrong here.
Right.
But there's some interesting things that were pointed out on Bleeding Cool, I think it is. And they were talking about how Hitch was talking a little bit about some of the problems that he had working with certain Marvel writers. And one of the ones that came up most often was Brian Michael Bendis, and how not anything to do with his personality or anything like that, but just the fact that in Brian Michael Bendis books, art kind of takes a back door because he is, and you know, he's a little better now than he used to be, but he's very dialogue heavy and very dialogue driven. And so Hitch was complaining a little bit about how, you know, he uses so much dialogue and there's so much talking and standing around talking that it doesn't even matter where the comic takes place, what the environment looks like, or what the characters are doing, because they just stand around and talk. Do you know what I mean? So it sounds like he was a little bit dismayed by that. And then so Bleeding Cool goes a little bit further to say that actually Angel Medina, I think I'm saying his name right, he turned down an opportunity to work with to pencil Bendis's books back in the New Avengers days, when I don't know if you remember with the New Avengers when they had that symbiote bomb arc,
right.
With the vents dropping out of the sky, and they had a really cool Lionel Yu cover with Wolverine as the Venom symbiote. That one, he turned down that arc. Medina did, saying that you know he had no interest in drawing the new, you know what? Well, first of all, he thought that New Avengers team was garbage, like the actual characters on the team. Uh-huh. And people that Bendis chose, you know, the Luke Cages and that kind of stuff. He's like, why would I draw them? And then I guess secondly, the other thing was that he didn't want to draw a bunch of these B-list characters standing around talking all day. So
right.
he said, yeah, I'll pass on the New Avengers stuff with Bendis. So I thought, you know, and I guess I should have known that, but it's kind of interesting to hear it said like that, because I guess as an artist, working with Bendis probably isn't that easy, because it's true. Like,
well, I think you have to be a certain type of artist. You know, Angel Medina is somebody who's a very, you know, very dynamic, and I just don't think that his art is suited for Bendis's work. I think you have to be a really good artist to make dialogue dynamic. But I think it can be done. And Bendis writes, I mean, yes, his books tend to be a little wordy sometimes, but usually that stuff is really good opportunities for good character development. And with the right artist, doing that, you can really develop a character visually with some really good facial cues and things like that, and body language, and there's so many things that you can use. And what this says to me is Angel Medina can't do that. And so, you know, okay, well, great. You know, I mean, screw you. So
I wonder too if it has anything to do with sort of the unsaid fact or the unstated fact that that Bendis is the spotlight. Do you know what I mean? Like, so like Hitch and Medina, they don't come out and say it, but does a little bit of this have to do with the fact that when you pick up a Bendis book, you're not talking about the art. Do you know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
A lot of artists in a lot of books, you pick up the book and, you know, there's going to be either equal mention of the writing and the art, or only sole mention of the art. Whereas when you pick up a Bendis book, it almost doesn't even matter who the artist is. It's always talk of Bendis, right? So I wonder if that has something to do with it too.
But here's a perfect example. That Ultimate Comics issue where it was where Peter reveals that he's Spider-Man to Mary Jane. That whole issue is one scene that takes place between those two characters, and they just talk through the whole issue. And that issue is freaking awesome because Mark Bagley knows how to draw dialogue. He knows how to draw those kind of intimate moments with between two characters. And so, I mean, I think it's, you know, I don't think that's any fault of Bendis that Angel Medina couldn't write his or draw his stuff. So,
well, and you know what it is too, is you have Medina, who's, you know, he's a great artist, and he's actually a lot like Greg Capullo.
Yes, I mean? Right.
They have that, they're kind of from that McFarlane school of thought. Uh-huh. In terms of the dynamics of their line and stuff like that. So yeah, I could see why those types of guys would have a difficult time drawing static scenes with somebody like Bendis.
Right, right.
Yeah. So the second interesting thing that I came across was something called, and again, maybe this is something you guys know all about, but for me, maybe it's just even the tag or the titling of it that I found amusing, that they call meta messages. Have you guys ever heard of meta messages in comics?
No.
Nope.
No? Tom, no?
Eli? No, not by that term.
No.
Do you mean like having a subliminal theme within a book or an analogy to a greater lesson that's not explicitly spelled out?
Well, close, kind of. So it's and you know, that's the meta part. Supposedly they've given this tag meta messages to anything that's inside of a comic where the creative team, either the artist or the writer, usually the writer, makes reference to another creative team. Do you know what I mean? And oftentimes it's not for good reasons. You know what I mean? Like they're making fun of another company or another writer or something like that. CBR though, they actually have an archive, believe it or not, of these meta messages. And so if you go to CBR, you can find their top 28 meta messages, and they have links so they can actually take you to a scan of the page where you can go through and see these meta messages. So I was flipping through them because I don't know, I found the whole concept kind of amusing, you know, and it's the kind of thing that we notice. It doesn't go by unnoticed, but I've never seen somebody take it and kind of put it in one place like that. Do you know what I mean? Where
right.
You can dissect and really go through it. So it was interesting. So, you know, here's a couple that I picked up on that were in there out of the many. One was a good one where John Byrne, he completely discredits Chris Claremont's Uncanny X-Men number 146. In issue 146, Claremont uses Dr. Doom, and he has this big plot going on with Dr. Doom. But I guess at the time, that messed with what was happening in Fantastic Four for John Byrne with Dr. Doom. So what Byrne did is he's got this whole page, I think it was two pages actually, where Doom goes on this little monologue about how there's this other Doom out there, but it's a Doom boss. You know what I mean? And he's posing as Doom. And it completely discredits the whole Claremont story.
Okay. Nice.
So, you know, and I don't know if Claremont, I'm sure Claremont must have caught wind of it, but at the time, probably not. And then in another one I thought was great and kind of ironic, Straczynski in Amazing Spider-Man number 516, he's got this panel that's got Spider-Man talking and with Mary Jane, and in the background the TV's on. And so they're doing the dialogue between Mary Jane and Spider-Man, and then in the background it's got the, you know, the jagged lines indicating what the television's saying. Yeah. And the whole thing is this whole stock market report about Time Warner and how, you know, their stocks are crashing and going down and how they own DC, and it has a lot to do with DC books. And it's like, he's totally smashing DC, you know what I mean, in the background in this thing. And now he writes for DC. So I thought that was kind of interesting too.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was one highlighted once on, I think it was one of our previous CSC podcasts. It was, there was an issue of Deadpool where he's training, I think it's Deadpool 9, like the, I don't know which series it was. It's the first one after Cable and Deadpool. But he was training a bunch of Super Scroll Warriors, and he makes a comment about how to be a superhero or whatever. And you're patches, you can't be patches. And he looks at him and says, right, Rob?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that was great.
and the Skrull's like, "Who's Rob?" He's like, "Oh, nobody important."
So just so you guys know, from now on, those are meta messages. That's what those are.
Well, would you count this one? I mean, in the latest issue of Uncanny X-Force, there's one little panel where Deadpool says to Wolverine, "Oh, everybody knows you weren't going to die," and Wolverine goes, "Everyone," and he says, and Deadpool points to the camera, or you know, the points at the reader, and says, "Yeah, look, everyone," and it's kind of like that whole Daniel Way, you know, breaking the fourth wall, Deadpool kind of thing. But then he says, "Yeah, everybody," and then the next panel is there's a security camera that he's pointing to. He's like, "Yeah, everybody who's watching on that security security camera." I mean, I don't know if that's really a meta message, but I mean, I think it plays with that idea where you know, Deadpool's always breaking the fourth wall, but in this circumstance, it was, I just thought that was a good way to kind of dispel, just get, I hate that fourth wall crap anyway, so just to kind of get rid of it was nice. So
you hate it, do you?
Yeah, I don't like it. So
I love it. I think 20 years from now, I think they're going to be dissecting everything that came out of Deadpool's mouth in a prophetic fashion. You know
what I mean? A reading from the prophet Wade Wilson.
But it's going to be this whole commentary on pop culture and creating this fourth element to it. Do you know what I mean? Like this fourth, like I think it's amazing. I absolutely relish it.
All right. Well, moving right along, we're going to jump into our fight. What we're going to call the Fight Club, and the question for our Fight Club really is this: could the Hulk actually beat Black Bolt in a fight? And just so everyone is aware, in World War Hulk, it turned out that Black Bolt was actually a Skrull, so that makes that fight null and void. But the fact that the Skrulls were even able to subdue and hold Black Bolt for an extended period of time is suspect in and of itself. So just think about that for a second. So what do you guys think? Black Bolt, Hulk.
Black Bolt.
Why?
All right. Perhaps the Skrulls would not have been able to use Force to stop Black Bolt, and Force is all Hulk has. It would have had to have been through some trickery or technological means. And I don't think Black Bolt is going to let himself get grabbed by the Hulk. Hulk has no distance attack, really. Black Bolt can fly. And I think his flight and his maneuverability, his matter manipulation, and his voice trumps anything Hulk brings to the table.
Anybody disagree?
Hulk.
Yeah, why?
Because he's the strongest one there is. You just can't match the durability and the incalculable strength that Hulk has. Right. And all the buzzing around Black Bolt's doing, all the yelling at him that he's doing, is just pissing him off even more.
And he does have a ranged attack. It's called that thunderclap.
Yeah, thunderclap.
Claps his hands together. Clap.
And the more Black Bolt zaps Hulk, the matter he's going to get, that makes him stronger, and eventually get up to World War Hulk levels, and then we'll see a beatdown like we saw in that book.
Yeah, I mean, both of these guys are essentially this like planet breakers, right? They could tear a planet in half. Each of these guys have that power to do so, but I don't know. Hulk just has the durability.
Ian, what do you think?
I think Black Bolt all day long.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I think one of the things that people forget about Black Bolt is that he has, I don't know the exact range, but it's something like class 50 strength. Like he's, so take away his voice, take away all of that stuff, his flight and everything.
Then he's half of Hulk.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, so to me, when you take that in terms of durability, right? He's right off the bat, he's as strong as like an Iron Man or you know, that kind of a character.
And then he's manhandled Thing before.
That's not a big feat. Nobody cares about the Thing.
I manhandle my Thing all the time. I'm kind of a feat that is.
Yeah, we know you do, Dan.
But then you throw his voice and stuff like that on top of that. So, like, and the only reason I bring that up is I think even if Hulk did get a hold of him, I think Black Bolt's actual class of strength gives him enough durability to take a couple of punches from the Hulk, distance himself, and then blast him again. It's one of those things, you know what? I kind of see this like a Wolverine-Hulk fight, but in the reverse. So what happens every time Wolverine fights the Hulk, Hulk basically throws him into another state. Wolverine eventually finds his way back. He throws him into another state again. Do you know what I mean? It's like that. I see the same thing with Hulk and Black Bolt, but on the reverse, where Black Bolt, with his voice, blasts Hulk, you know, into a different section of the country, basically. Hulk's got to get back, hits him again. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's one of those things where it's just Hulk taking a beating all day long and Black Bolt having to exert next to no energy to do it.
I see it as completely different.
But if Hulk got a hold of Black Bolt, though, and he just happened to, like, would Black Bolt's durability be enough to withstand Hulk crushing his trachea?
No. Yeah, because Hulk's never gotten a hold of anybody. That's the whole thing, right?
What are you talking about?
You look at Hulk's fights, right? How often does Hulk get a hold of somebody? Like, what he does is Hulk will give them one punch or one thunderclap or one this or one that. But, how often do you see Hulk grab somebody, right, not let them go, and just pound them into pudding? Do you know what I mean?
Loki. Like, Loki.
So, one time during World War Hulk when he did that to Wolverine.
Yeah, but
it has to be thrown out. I mean, it's World War Hulk. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's what I was just gonna say. You know what? Using World War Hulk is like these guys saying Loki. You know what I mean? It's like that's a different universe.
Exactly.
You know, it's not even 616. Like it's, I know it is, but it's not.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, I just I don't see even how. I mean, I know that Black Bolt's voice is strong, but I don't see that subduing him. You could argue that Black Bolt used his full force against Vulcan in that fight during War of Kings. That did not stop Vulcan. Now,
I'm sorry, but his power.
It ripped him apart, but it did not subdue him. Vulcan still got up and still continued to fight him until they both ended up dying or whatever in the explosion. I don't see Vulcan in the same class as Hulk. I don't see the voice of Black Bolt tearing through Hulk's flesh.
But Black Bolt did subdue Hulk, right? Like that before World War Hulk, Black Bolt, that's one of his claims to fame, is he did. He knocked out the Hulk, right?
Right.
So
So why are we discussing this?
What's that?
So why are we discussing this?
Because Dan and Tom have it wrong.
Yeah. I know that you guys don't play comics, so I thought I'd give you a shot.
Oh, okay, thanks. Okay, good.
I was thinking that Black Bolt could blast Hulk into orbit, and then there's nowhere for Hulk to go, nothing to push off of. He can't fly, so how would he propel himself in space?
Hmm. And Black Bolt can use the best matter manipulation to basically hold Hulk, 50 feet off the ground and 100 yards away from him, and just hold him there. I mean, he has used that power before to stop missiles from flying right at his face without touching them. He just grabbed them with his ability to channel electrons and all that, whatever crap that is. What's Hulk going to do if he has nothing to push off of? Or, like Tom said, if he gets thrown into orbit. I mean, it's done. It's over. Hulk can't do that. If Hulk throws Black Bolt up in the air, Black Bolt just flies back down and screams at him.
Yeah, but here my point is that if Hulk gets a hand on him and can grasp him, then that's it. That's the fight is over.
Look what he did to Ultimate Wolverine, right? I mean, Hulk should be strong enough to essentially just grab Black Bolt if he can, but if he does, grab Black Bolt and just tear him in half.
Yeah.
But why was Black Bolt able to knock him out in the past And if Hulk gets stronger, the madder he gets, he won't be that strong for a little while.
He knocked him out in the past because I wasn't riding him.
Oh, Dan.
Yeah. Well, very good. Well, so let's take a vote. There's five of us. We can decide this definitively. Let's say Dan, what's your vote?
Hulk.
Eli.
Black Bolt.
Tom.
I'm gonna have to say Black Bolt.
Oh, come on, Tom.
Excuse me.
Ian.
I think I'm gonna have to say Black Bolt.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, no. I'm gonna vote Hulk. So, by squeaking out a little bit of a win there, Black Bolt wins. So, thanks a lot, Tom.
Sorry.
Hulk tells everybody that he's the strongest there is. Black Bolt is the strongest that there is. I think.
Black Bolt's bullshit. You. I love that part in Indestructible Hulk where, the first issue where. Is it the Mad Thinker?
Yeah.
Thinks he's got it all solved, right? He's like, okay, I can calculate how much strength and just equally match that and surpass it to be able to do anything you can. And that's when the Mad Thinker realizes as he's fighting the Hulk that he's got it all wrong because Hulk's strength is incalculable. So any math he tries to do doesn't work
right
to measure Hulk's strength.
But it's not like that was...
What? It's not like it was what? Uh-oh. Did we lose him? Oh, well.
I wanted to hear this because if it's not like, you know, if that it's fiction. Yeah, because electron manipulation, that's totally based on physics.
Yeah.
No, I can finish the sentence for him.
Okay, go for it.
It's not like that matters because the Hulk sucks.
Oh, okay. Oh, then I'm gonna switch my vote. Then there you go.
The Hulk's green and he's stupid, and they made bad movies about him.
Yeah. All right. Moving right along.
Is it me? Is it me?
Yeah, it's you. It's you.
Do you want to do trending or do you want to skip it?
It's up to you, pal.
Okay, yeah, let's do it real fast and see what everybody thinks. Okay.
Sounds
so
good.
What we're going to do, this kind of – now that we've talked about it, it kind of fits into the what's hot and what's not. But I guess not. I guess not actually. Forget it. So what we have now is a trending section, and the trending section is supposed to mimic sort of or look at comics in general and the comic world in general and kind of look at what's hot, what's not, and what's trending in comics and hopefully maybe determine some patterns and things like that in the comic book world. I thought this would be an interesting section to do, especially because, you know, for all of us, we're all longtime comic readers, and I don't know about you guys, but I feel a little bit kind of smug in the sense that current pop culture right now, in basically every form on every level, is based on the shit that we've been telling them is cool forever. Do you know what I mean? So
we're the trendsetters, yeah.
That's right.
Nerd culture rules, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Whether it's television shows, movie, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. All of the top stuff right now, the most popular things right now are based on the things that we've been interested in our whole lives. And, you know, for the longest time, you know, for me anyway, you know, I basically hid my obsession with comics because I didn't want to be made fun of by people. And now it's like, you know,
right?
I don't know. So I thought we could maybe look at the trending of it a little bit, and see how you guys feel about it. So we broke it down into a what's hot and what's not section, and we're hoping that that these things will move throughout the weeks a little bit up and down in the what's hot and what's not section. So I threw a few things in here. Feel free to chime in. Feel free to tell me that I'm completely wrong. There's a few in here that I'm sure you will. So under the what's hot section, I thought that, you know, like I just said, one of the biggest things right now is at first I had number one as superhero movies. But then after I put the next one, I moved superhero movies down to number two and moved my number two to number one, which is now superhero movie merchandising. And the reason why I put superhero movie merchandising as number one is basically because it's the Christmas season right now. So I've been out shopping and, you know, buying things for my kids and stuff. And my son is a, you know, thankfully, you know, I love it. He's a diehard comic fan. Like, he's absolutely crazy about anything superhero. So as I've been going out there and, you know, looking for things to get him for Christmas, I can't get over how much money is being made right now in superhero merchandising, movie merchandising. Like, holy cow. The amount of money that they're making is unbelievable. Like, it's just crazy. I don't know if you guys have noticed it. Like, t-shirts, toys, posters, you know.
There are people, just regular old people, walking around with Spider-Man t-shirts on. Like, that's...
Yeah, Captain America Shield shirts. Those have been popular since the movie.
Right.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Yeah, you go to Old Navy. Do you guys have Old Navy in the States?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you go to Old Navy, their whole t-shirt section, it's all superhero t-shirts.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's all of them. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's crazy.
Do you remember? I mean, I can remember being like, oh, man, I really, really want a comic book t-shirt. And the only place that you could always get them was at your crusty old... local comic shop, and they would have either like a big box full of t-shirts wrapped in plastic, or they might have them actually hanging up on a rack, but then they wouldn't have your size or whatever. But
are you guys old enough to remember Underoos?
Oh yeah, I'm wearing them right now.
Still make them.
I think so.
I was like 8, but that was for a couple of years there. That was like my birthday presents were always like Superman or Green Lantern or Batman underoos.
Oh yeah, my kids all wear those. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's
my kids, in quotes.
Toys. Like, you look at the toys now. So like, I go out and I buy a Phantom X action figure. You know what I mean? Like, are you serious? One of my favorite sort of, I don't know, what would you say, like B-list, C-list.
Yeah, obscure, very obscure.
Yeah, and, well, that's the whole. That's become a whole collection item itself. When I was a kid, we had the Mikko superhero dolls, and those were awesome. They were actual like 12-inch action figures.
The ones which you could take off the costumes.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, I'd switch the. I had like an old Superman. I went through, you know, half a dozen of each one, and like one of my old Supermans, the costume, the legs had torn off, so I basically made it into a. Supergirl. The Supergirl came with her 70s hot pants costume, so I took an old Superman uniform and made it into like her original 1950s costume, you know, with the skirt. And, things like that. I was always changing around, changing costumes and everything.
But when I was growing up, and I don't know if this is a Canadian thing or not, I couldn't get an action figure of like Captain America or Iron Man. Like, there's no such thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and now, like, now I'm in the process of finishing my collection of the Wrecking Crew action figures.
Comic shops kind of started all that, and Marvel buying toy bids helped a lot, too, because they can just mass-produce any character they want. But even DC's in it as well, in that they, you know, with the direct comic shops have now gone to merchandising, that gives them more of an outlet for the action figures. So, for a while there was a dearth of them. You had Secret Wars figures in the 80s, and that was – and Superpowers. Yeah. But they were just like little Star Wars-sized action figures, and not much in the 80s. But they had the 90s that started taking off, and now it's pretty much any character. Now they do things like Blackest Night. They put all the zombie superheroes out.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. It's crazy. My son – and they start them at a young age, right? My son's big into the superhero squad. So he's got like 50 of the superhero squad characters. He's got a little mini MODOK. Do you know what I mean? And not only does he have a MODOK, he knows who MODOK is.
Right.
Like, if MODOK comes on the TV, he's like, Dad, it's MODOK. You know what I mean? Like, he knows who MODOK is. I didn't know who MODOK was until a couple of years ago. You know what I mean?
Well, and so I think there's we can kind of grouse about, you know, that we were in on the ground floor of this. But I mean, for me, I think it's awesome. For my birthday this past year, my kids got me an Iron Man helmet.
Yeah.
Like, I have Iron Man's helmet in my room. I'm holding it right now.
It talks.
How cool is that?
It's true, though, right? We couldn't watch superhero stuff on TV. We couldn't own clothing of it, toys of it. It basically existed in our books and in our imagination, and that's it.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And now it's like, It's everywhere. It's crazy. Oh, so anyways,
the world that exists now is only we couldn't have even dreamed of when we were kids.
No, gosh, no, yeah. Absolutely not. And that's why I put number one as what's hot is superhero movie merchandising. I think it's absolutely insane. And then number two is superhero movies. I find it amazing how every time a new movie comes out, and me and my wife are looking at trailers or whatever, I'm like, oh yeah, that's based on a comic book. That's based on a book. That's based on a book. I read that book. You know what I mean? Like it's all based on these books, you know, and you can see why people like Scott Snyder write every single book in, it has a real movie feel to it.
Yes. You know what I mean? Right.
Because they know there's millions and millions of dollars for them to be made if somebody picks up their book. Right. So,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you know, the new Man of Steel trailer just came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's going to be a big one next year. They've also put out casting notices for the new Spider-Man. And then there's also, they're moving forward a new Fantastic Four reboot. And plus all the Avengers movies are now going in their second cycle.
Yeah,
I think Guardians of the Galaxy, isn't that Thor 2's mm-hmm. next and Iron Man 3, but then there's Guardians of the Galaxy coming out too,
mm-hmm.
and the Wolverine comes out next May.
Yeah.
I think we get four comic book movies next summer. We get Superman, Wolverine, Thor, and Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah, that's just the major ones. That's not including things like Kick-Ass 2. I think it's coming out in sometime.
Right.
Yeah, they're just finishing production now, I think.
Yeah. And not only that, but TV as well. You've got Arrow on CW now, and that's actually really good. Otherwise, watch.
It is a good series. Yeah,
that's a good
like
segue.
It.
Good segue there.
Yeah.
To number three on the What's Hot is comics. Comic stuff for TV. That's another big thing. Yeah. Who I was watching. I was watching Love Actually. My wife and I were watching Love Actually. We always watch it around Christmas time, and Andrew Lincoln. Is in that, and I was just sitting there thinking, it's amazing to me. He just played such a bit part in that movie, and now he's this huge superstar because of The Walking Dead. It's just amazing to me
character is he?
He's Rick Grimes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's just amazing to me how that show has blown up. It's absolutely amazing. Like, I have friends who never read any comic books or anything, and like they were lamenting the fact that I guess the season 3 is on a hiatus until next year of Walking Dead, and so she posted on Facebook, she said, what am I going to do until the next part of The Walking Dead, and I immediately wrote, there's a whole comic book and you could probably read that in the meantime and get your fix. So it's amazing to me what this TV show has kind of done. So,
well, and walking into my local comic book store now is a nightmare. Like, it's like, especially this time of year, I go in there and what it used to be when I go in on Wednesday, there'd be me and two other guys that were in there all the time, and it was always the same two guys. You know what I mean? Other than the people that work there, and now I go in and there's people asking for Doctor Who stuff and Walking Dead stuff, and do you know what I mean? Like, it's absolutely crazy. My daughter, who's 8, she was really sick this summer for a few days, and just laying on the couch, and I didn't know what to do with her. I wanted to keep her occupied. So, and you know, I might have already told you the story. I don't know. Here's the quality parenting that I provide up here in the Great White North. So on Netflix, I put on Buffy the Vampire Slayer for her, right? Yeah. So I thought, you know, because she's kind of into that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? And she's not like Twilight vampires, but she's more into like the gritty kind of, you know. And then I thought, oh, you know, the teen beautiful heroine, she might buy this. You know what I mean? So I throw it on for her. Well, she just recently, I think last month, finished watching all the seven seasons, right? So she's watched every single season of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and she is an absolute Buffy addict. You know what I mean? And she just loves it. She just loves it. So I think it's not to use some big fancy term or anything like that, but I think it's kind of a zeitgeist thing.
Yes.
Like, I think it's a cultural feeling in the air right now where this superhero stuff is just sticking. Now, the sad thing is I don't know how much this is translating to the books. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I don't know if this is translating to readers, if this is translating to comic book readers.
Well, I think the reading's shifting. I think comics as the floppies, you know, as the paper copies is kind of fading. But then all the major companies are now tied in with multimedia empires. You know, DC's been owned by Time Warner for ages. And Marvel now is owned by Disney, so it's now now that CGI has finally caught up to where you can do a real superhero movie and actually have it not look, you know, like matte paintings and superimposed, you know, flying and so on. Now that it actually can look cool, now you're getting now it's going into the whole market. You've got the video, you know, Batman's big because of the Nolan movies and because of the Arkham Asylum game, and video games have gotten into it as well. So it's all tying together into one big cultural thing, and the books are the jumping off point. Reading habits are shifting as well. I mean, nowadays you can download comics you want off of Comixology or one of the major comics apps, and you download your copies every month, so you don't buy the printed copies anymore. And trades have been replacing, for a lot of casual readers, trades have now replaced individual issues.
Right.
Issues are more of just a collector thing, and the source material, and it's becoming now that the major writers are lining, you know, they're having offers lining up to buy their material to make movies from them, because that's what's hot right now.
This is a big conversation for us, though, as educators right now, in looking at, you know, and I hate the term because it's thrown around, at least up here, so often now in the education system, but it's the whole 21st century learner. And a big topic for us now is basically, is reading dead? Like, is actual reading dead? Because we get our reading in so many different ways now. Is sitting down and reading a book, is that dead? Is it dead and gone? And I think it might be. Do you know what I mean? And I don't mean dead as in, like, put the nail in the coffin, right, it's gone. But I think it might be on its way out. And I think the days of us trying to convince kids to be readers, I don't know. I think it's gone. I think it's leaving. You know what I mean? Like, they do a lot of reading, but very non-conventional text. You know what I mean? Like, so they're reading a ton, but it's always based on a monitor. Do you know what I mean? Whether it's their television, their phone, their iPod, their computer, their iPad, whatever. They do a lot of reading, but not, it's non-continuous text. Do you know what I mean? So it's constant pop-up images. It's constant little hits of information. It's never really 500 pages of reading. Do you know what I mean?
Right. I still think there's a huge book market, though. Because like with my wife being the aspiring author, I mean, we go to book conventions once or twice a year, and the turnout is huge. You know, admittedly, it's a lot of teenage girls. Teenage girls are very much into books, a lot more than teenage boys are. But I think for print books, there's still a huge market out there.
Yeah, I was going to mention the tween girls area is still very hot, because that's where you have that's where Twilight and I Am Number 4 and Hunger Games and all that came from. And that genre is still very hot. They're filming. There are another couple of series they're adapting for the next couple of years.
Mortal Instruments.
Yeah, Mortal Instruments. That's the one I was thinking of.
Divergent is being filmed.
I don't even know what those are.
Stephanie Meyer's got a new one called The Host, which was written as a movie. It's not a book series yet. I'm sure it will be. Maximum Ride is supposed to be made in a movie, and even older ones like Ender's Game is coming out as a movie.
Yeah. Now, see, though, you know, in the classroom, I see a completely different trend. And I think it's just my classroom. I don't by any means see this as a wide thing, but it's definitely, I can put it under the category of trend, because I've seen it over the course of the past, I'd say, seven years or so. And that would be that my boys read way more than my girls. Now, mind you, the thing with that, too, is I have about 200 graphic novels or trade paperbacks that I keep in my classroom, and the boys love it. Do you know what I mean? They eat it up. But the girls, I also have tripled the amount of that in novels. But over the past 7 years, I'd have to say that my boys are far more avid readers than my girls. And none of those two groups read novels. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'll get a student who does, or maybe two students out of a class of 30. But that's it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just don't see that reading hunger like I used to see.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, there was this past summer, I ended up meeting up with a group of us, of teenage boys who were ended up coming out wakeboarding with me a good bit. It would be kind of funny that I'd make some pop culture reference. I get this blank stare back. It was so funny. They had no clue what I was talking about. It'd be something that, you know, to me was practically yesterday, but they did no reading. In fact, their school was they went to a charter school that's it does online learning. So they basically go in instead of a computer and do all their lessons on the computer. And they have teachers there just as proctors, basically.
Yeah.
And ask questions of. But they actually don't. I don't know how much they actually read. I know they do a lot of texting, but that's about it. That's never heard them mention opening a book for anything.
Right.
Well, so this is a good segue for we'll go from our what's hot to our what's not section. And for me, and I'd love the feedback on this one, because this might just be more of a personal opinion for me. I don't think so, but we'll see. What's not hot for me would be the big one is digital comics. I know personally, in the past year or so, there's a couple that I downloaded because I wanted to give it a try and, give it its day in court kind of thing. It just doesn't work for me. And for me, that even goes so far as the AR stuff, where, for the first little while, I was showing lots of people the AR stuff in the Marvel books. And, it was more of like, it was like this little trick almost. And now I can't remember the last time that I've used that function. I've used the AR thing. So I see the pages as I'm flipping through the comics and I see the AR symbol. I never check it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And same with the free digital downloads to me. And maybe I'm just lazy or something like that. I don't download them. It's just not worth the trouble. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, I should. Like, why am I not taking advantage of these free digital comics? But I don't. Do you know what I mean? So, for me,
I'm way behind on mine. I've got like two boxes of them that are separate, waiting for me to sit down and actually enter all the codes. The problem is if there's a way to say take a picture of your phone and have it scan it for you, that would be one thing. But having to sit there and type these 20-character long tables and numbers and lessons and do a free comic.
Well, that's
don't forget they expire in a year too.
Yeah, I've got a couple I have to get to. Well, I'm only like 6 months behind, but yeah, I'm aware it's only a year. So
I heard an interesting discussion about digital comics and how, the thing is that if Comixology or Marvel, most of these are Marvel, DC, they're all powered really by Comixology. If something were to ever happen to Comixology, you would lose all of your digital copies.
Mm-hmm.
So honestly, I mean, it's controversial, but a more viable digital option is torrenting comics, because you get to keep the actual file yourself. If you're into collecting, then and that translates into digital, then that makes more sense. I mean, now then you get in the whole debate of illegal downloading and all of that kind of stuff, but I download the free stuff from the books that I get, I like that, just because I can read them from anything, from my mm-hmm. wife's iPad, from my iPhone. I like that functionality. I actually use that a lot more when I go back and read things, if I go back and read things. But the AR stuff, mainly because I think that AR app, there's something wrong with it. I can never get it to work. Like, I'll sit there and hold it over, whether it's my phone or whatever, I'll hold it over and it won't do anything. And I'm like, well, screw this. I mean, it takes me, 20 minutes to read a comic book because I want to see this stupid interview with Matt Fraction or whatever. It's just dumb. So I don't think
90% of the time, it's just the image going from sketch to ink to colored. Yeah. It's like so uninteresting.
They haven't come to the full realization of what that could really be. I mean, I think, eventually, if you could have something that scanned that had little links to, okay, who's this character, and here's a website that and a link that goes to this, and I think you could integrate it a little bit more. But I think digital comics, are, you know, especially being in a rural area like I am, I don't have a local comic shop here. So, I mean, I have one that's like 30 miles away, but knowing that I can get any comic book within minutes is really kind of cool. So,
yeah, and it also helps take the premium off of some of these comics that are that sell out instantly, and you can't get a copy anywhere else. You can at least buy them. My biggest problem is just that the cover price is the same as for the paper copy.
Yeah,
so here's what I would say. I would maybe change this for what's actually not trending, I think, is collecting comic books. Does that make sense? I think reading comic books is a trend, but collecting them, I think the whole idea of, and I think this is just my way of reading is now changing. Like, it used to be, you know, I had to get every issue of everything, you know, and bag and board it and do all that kind of stuff and put it on in my little filing system and log it into my, you know, database and do all that and be very meticulous about my collecting habits. These days, really, what I'm doing now is I'm really just kind of waiting for trades on most of the major things that I collect. I mean, I'll read them and then, you know, and then I'll get the collected edition. And so I'm not so interested in collecting individual issues anymore.
See, to me, in that aspect, I always wonder if it's a chicken or an egg thing, in the sense that, you know, in the old days or whatever, you used to collect, and, you know, I collect Amazing Spider-Man, and no matter how crappy the book would get, I would still buy it every month because it's part of my collection. But then they started with all the relaunches, right? Renumbering, relaunches, and this even going way back before it's even a trend here. I think, is it because the publishers started basically, I don't know how you would say it, but started training us to, or basically making us not want to keep collecting? Or is it the reader that started dropping books when they started getting shitty? You know, it's a chicken or an egg thing, and I was just, to me, it's just, I don't know which came first.
Well, the interesting thing for me is this whole Marvel Now thing. I'm now collecting books that I would have never collected before, like Thor, and Fantastic Four. I mean, I'm reading those books, and I've never read those before, and I'm actually for the first time cutting the apron strings on the X-Men books, and I'm saying, mm-hmm. you know, this is a perfect time to just jump off and forget that this, because it's not in the overall scheme, this is not going to affect anything. So, you know, it used to be I would have collected Cable and X-Force just because it was Cable and X-Force, but now I'm kind of like, well, okay. I mean, I'll give it a try, give the first arc a try maybe, but after that, then that's it. So
yeah, I think I've mentioned this to Andy before, and Andy has he had the exact opposite opinion. But the my view is like is what Dan said, is that it's not only they keep doing the reboots and relaunches and renumberings to supposedly bring in casual readers or new readers who would feel daunted picking up a book at issue 535 or something, but for the longtime collectors, it's also it can backfire because it's also a good jumping off point.
It makes us give up, basically.
Exactly right.
I mean, that's the thing is, yeah, DC just over a year ago just basically nerfed everything that I'd spent 40 years collecting. So it's perfect jumping off point for some books. Although actually I haven't ever gotten around to updating my list, so I'm still reading everything.
Right.
But I don't plan to keep it that way. And
that's the other funny thing too, because we're looking at, you know, once in a while, because my wife collects some books too, and we take a look at our pull list and reassess them, right? And it's like, okay, where are we at with this series? It's like, well, right now this is going on. And then we sort of decide, okay, well, this story right now is really crappy, so keep buying it until that story is over, and then we're going to stop the comic. We're going to stop having it on our pull list. We're still in that collector's mindset where we really can't jump off in the middle of something. It just annoys us to no end.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of readers nowadays have no problem with that. They're like, this book is crappy, I'm not going to bother reading the rest of the story, I'm not buying it again.
Yeah, and I think that's just outgrowth of continuity. When you know, it used to be comics were pretty much self-contained stories, maybe an issue or two, but that would be it. Nowadays, everything's done in arcs so that they can collect into trades.
That's right.
So you don't have a whole lot of plot points that carry on beyond the story arc itself. There are a few character development things, but you don't really miss much. So nowadays, with everything kind of divided into arcs, it makes it easier to break it off.
But that's funny, because if you talk about a series like X-Factor, where if you're reading single issues, if you just grab a single issue here and there, it's a series that totally sucks. No reader could pick out an issue out of a stack of X-Factor, read it, and say that they liked it. I'd have a hard time believing that. True but that. To someone who's been reading it, well, it's true. It's just the way that it's been written, right? And Marvel lets Peter David do his own thing because the book still sells consistently, and that's because of the people that have been reading X-Factor since volume 3, right? And it's just one long story that it's its own little universe thing, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of been lost. That was why Claremont was so successful for 16 years with X-Men, was that it was a long saga, and it having one writer on it that long meant that the longtime readers, people who were reading it, kept reading it because he was writing it. And when he quit, he quit right at the beginning of the whole 90s boom. So that was, that's when X-Men started going downhill. But it got really progressively worse after the end of the century. But Claremont came back, and even that didn't help. He apparently lost his mojo. But
yeah,
right.
But I'm sure when Peter David quits X-Factor, that series is going to be canceled.
Oh, it's over.
They're not even going to bother looking for another creative team.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's too bad.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I think it's migrated so far away from the regular X universe that I don't know that they'd even want to bring it back. They'd probably just break it up and relaunch the series with number one again.
Right.
I think, though, for me, and you know, maybe we can close on this point, I think that, personally, I think publications are going to start to drop. I think that sales are going to start to drop of actual physical comics. And I think that in terms of a collector's market, which I know none of us have ever been interested in, I think in the upcoming years, you're going to see the biggest collector's market ever. And I don't mean collector's market as in the general population will know that it's a collector's market, but in 20 years from now, when they look back at it, this will be the collector's market, because it'll be the death knell of comics a little bit.
Yeah,
and nobody's buying them. Do you know what I mean? And people will open those books.
Whereas the 90s was booming, everything had 8 million copies for it. Nowadays, it's 10 and 20,000.
Well, yeah.
Eventually, it'll be a very it'll be a very short supply in the future.
Did you see what Image Comics was? I don't know if they're still planning to do this or what, but basically they told retailers that they are no longer going to start reprinting. You know, like Saga, for instance, that book, it went back to like the fifth or sixth printing or whatever. And basically Image said, we're no longer going to be doing that. We're going to make one printing of these books, and that's it.
Yeah.
And retailers kind of were up in arms. And I don't know if Image came back with some kind of I don't know if it was complete retraction of that idea, but but there was, I think once people start floating that idea out there, you're going to start seeing, books come out, and they're going to have one printing, and then you can get them digitally, those first printing books are going to be hard to find, and they're going to become collector's items. So
true collector's items, not the ones labeled collector's items.
Right.
I think the collector's market is ahead of us. I think that over the course of maybe the next 10 years, maybe that's too long, but somewhere in that neighborhood, maybe 7 years, you're going to see some real collectible books come out.
So are you saying that I could put my kids through college with my comics collection? Maybe?
Maybe.
Probably not. All right.
Okay, so let's get to our fight of the week.
All right. So in this segment, what we're going to be doing for our fights this this season is instead of kind of doing the tournament style that we've been doing before, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to take a category of fighter that will be chosen in advance. For example, like a flyer or a matter manipulator or omega level character or something. And each guest will be asked to secretly pick one fighter who fits that category to defend against all the other managers. So it'll be kind of a free-for-all. If multiple guests pick the same fighter, then they can gang up on the other hosts or guests. If the majority of guests vote that a particular fighter violates that week's cap, the fighter will be disallowed and the manager publicly shamed as a cheater. So for this week, guests are going to be asked to pick one female street-level fighter. The fight will take place in the Forbidden City in Beijing, China. So how do we want to do this?
Now that it's actually happening, you know what we should have had?
What?
We should have one person who's not playing.
Yes.
And all the fighters are submitted to that one person.
Okay.
And that way nobody changes their fighter as the fighters are being listed.
Okay. Well, you know that's true. Yeah.
I'm going to say mine, and then people are going to change theirs.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
But that's okay.
Well, we can kind of agree right now that and it'll just be a gentleman's agreement that we will go for our first pick, and if that if that first pick is duplicated by somebody else, then we'll do it that way.
I like that. Let's gentleman's agreement.
Okay.
Yeah. We're all gentlemen here, so.
I actually had three options just in case somebody picked mine. So yeah, I'll go with my first pick.
Just go with your first pick.
So I'll go first.
Okay.
I'm gonna take Domino.
Ah! Damn you! So that's mine, Domino.
You're gonna go Domino?
Yep. I'm on your team there, pal.
There we go. All right, Tom, what do you think?
I was gonna do Lady Deathstrike.
Nice. That's
a good one. And Dan?
Mystique.
Ooh.
That's a really good one.
That is good. And Eli is somehow, so he got dropped off the call a while back, so he's not here.
Good.
So there you go.
Okay. So, who was, hey, before we start, who were your backups? Jeff, who was your backup?
I didn't have a backup. Domino was my only, well, I will say, I was going to maybe throw in Psylocke. If you would have allowed her level
I wasn't sure if she'd be a street level fighter, but
yeah, Psylocke would have been a public shunning. That would have been a shame, right?
okay good.
Yeah. Tom, how about you?
My second choice was X-23, my third choice is Black Widow, and my fourth choice was Domino, although yeah, she might have been my third. I didn't really clarify beyond that point, but
that's funny, your list is very similar to mine. My second choice was X-23, and my third choice was Black Widow. Now, mind you, though, Mystique was just totally off the radar for me. If that would have popped into my mind, that would have been on there, too. Dan, did you have any backup picks?
Yeah, I had Shadowcat and Elektra.
Yeah, I thought of those two.
I thought about Shadowcat. Elektra was one of my first choices. I'm like, now everybody's going to pick her.
And I had one, my actual first pick before I started looking at a roster of ladies. The first one that came to mind to me was Typhoid Mary, Mutant Zero.
Oh yeah, that's cool. Ooh. All right.
So the fight takes place in the Forbidden City, Beijing, China. I know we've used that before in a past COC. I don't remember which one. I think it was back in the day, actually.
Yeah.
So, you know, for those of you unfamiliar, it's the one where, it's big, right? It's not just one place, but it's famous for those crazy underground statues of the entire army. Do you know what I'm talking
about? Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Very cool stuff. my first exposure to that city at all was actually through the very first Contest of Champions miniseries back in the 80s. And that was one of the environments for one of their fights as well. I think Black Panther and Wolverine fought in the Forbidden City, if I remember right.
Cool.
Okay. So who wants to start off? How do you want to start this?
I don't know. Back in the day, we used to have a coin toss. I don't know. Let's say...
Why don't we have our double team start it, and since our moderators never get to get
back. There we go. That's a good idea. Go ahead, Ian. Kick it off.
So I like Domino in this category as a female street level fighter, because for many reasons. I like her because she's a very layered fighter, in the sense that she brings many, many, many different attributes to this fight. If you take away all of her powers, like every single power that she has, she's still, I think, an incredibly capable hand-to-hand fighter. And not just an incredibly capable hand-to-hand fighter, but she's a weapons expert as well, as a top-rated assassin who people hire to kill people. And then you take all of that and you throw on top of it the fact that she has this mutant ability to, it's almost like a chaos power, a lot like Scarlet Witch's, where it's a good luck power. So things just happen to happen for her. Do you know what I mean? You know, someone's sneaking up behind her and some ceiling tile will fall out and fall on their head and she never has to worry about them, that kind of thing. So she has this amazing luck power as well, which, I don't know. I don't see how anybody could fight against it, to tell you the truth. You know, Domino's one of those people that you never really see lose a fight in comics.
Right.
She might have, somebody might get the upper hand on her for all of a couple of seconds, and then something, of course, unfortunate happens to them, and the fight turns the other way. The closest that I've ever seen happen to Domino where, you know, things didn't go well for her was in a Deadpool. Was it a Deadpool book or was it an X-Men book that Deadpool was in?
I don't know.
I think it was a Deadpool book, and that's the one where Deadpool. I don't know if any of you guys ever read it, where Deadpool brought Domino back to his place, where his base of operations, and she fell through the ceiling into his pool, but his pool was filled with pancakes. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
No. I did not read that.
Acted out stuff you've ever seen in your life, and it was when Deadpool figured out that Domino was deathly afraid of chickens.
Oh, right. Yeah. I didn't know that. I always like to take kind of what's currently going on in continuity. And right now, the latest issue that Domino was in Adjectiveless X-Men. And she had a little solo story with where she was teaming up with Daredevil. And basically what she does, even before she teams up with Daredevil, is she goes by herself into this casino, this underground casino of supervillains, and she goes in completely by herself, really mainly because she just wanted to have a little fun and really start some trouble and beat up on some supervillains. I mean, that was her entire point. She gets kind of wrapped up in this larger story with Daredevil, but she ends up kind of fighting all of these pretty big class villains. Well, big class in terms of power, I would say. She and Daredevil fend off the Wrecking Crew, which, you know, these guys have fought, you know, Thor. And there you go. You can say, well, writing, whatever. But there it is in continuity. But her fighting prowess, but also in terms of the probability manipulation and just the amount of luck that she would have. So against somebody like Lady Deathstrike or Mystique, I think with Domino's weapons, I think she can keep a safe distance from both of these folks. I mean, I think if you get up to a little too close to Lady Deathstrike, you're gonna get some stabby stabby. But even then, I think if it was just hand-to-hand, some kind of probability would happen. One of these giant statues here in Beijing would topple over, in the Forbidden City, would topple over and crush one of the other people. The thing is that for all of the luck that is on Domino's side, what that spells out is bad luck for everybody else who's around Domino. So the odds are not in the favor of the other fighters against Domino in this.
Now, doesn't Domino have to be aware of what's happening for luck power to work, or is it innate? Is it just happen?
It just happens, and in fact, it happens more when she's in a stressful situation. So she doesn't have to consciously make something happen. It just that's part of her. There's almost like a probability field in her general vicinity, and so the more action that she's in, the more subconsciously these probability fields are playing a role. So.
Yeah, it's usually just things kind of fall her way. I mean, that's where the domino comes from. Is
exactly.
It's like she'll make a lucky shot. She'll shoot at someone and miss them, but hit a ricochet that will bounce off three corners and hit the target or something.
There's a little bit of spider sense involved here too. I mean, like if Mystique pulls a gun and starts shooting at her, she can dodge the bullets. That's part of the probability and the luck. So in terms of ranged attack, she's great because she can't really be hit very very often. So there you go. Ian, you want to throw anything else about Domino? Hello?
Hold on, I had to unmute my mic.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, you know what? I think what I would throw in is I would talk a little bit about Lady Deathstrike and Mystique. I think that when it comes to Lady Deathstrike, I think that Domino's going to have more of a ranged attack. When it comes to Lady Deathstrike, I think that she's going to be able to. There's lots of hiding places for her in the Forbidden City, and with her gun expertise and the type of arsenal that she carries with her, I think she's got a lot of weaponry to help take out somebody like Lady Deathstrike out of a fight like this. I think her main challenge is going to come from Mystique, who can obviously camouflage and hide herself well in a large area like this. And I think when it comes to Mystique, then Domino will just have to rely on her luck powers to help Mystique probably make a mistake while in camouflage to expose herself, and then Domino will exploit that. All right. Tom, you want to try?
Yeah, I was trying to check up one thing, but Deathstrike, of course, the reason I chose her was that she's got, of course, the healing factor, the strength of Zed, and of course her big balls. That's not really going to factor in here, but she's also a master fighter as well. She has adamantium skeleton. What I was wanting to check on was if she has enhanced senses like Wolverine. I think she does have cybernetics. With her cybernetics, she has enhanced senses, I believe. But so she's basically a living arsenal, and also being a trained martial artist, she has the stealth skills. She's basically going to be able to in the Forbidden City, which is a very large palace with walls and lots of grottos and places to hide. She's going to be able to move around unseen and basically stalk the other two. In Mystique's case, she'll be able to detect. While Mystique can probably blend in with the tourists floating around, Deathstrike's going to be able to detect her basically scanning the crowd. And Domino, similarly, she will be able to see her even if she's hiding in the dark from heat signature, her energy field with she being a mutant, she's going to throw some sort of. She'll throw off energy, or just her scent would be different, something that she's encountered before. And then, of course, in hand-to-hand with the healing factor and the adamantium, she's pretty much indestructible. So Domino can throw a lot of munitions at her, but she's shown she can take punishment. She's been sliced and diced by Wolverine and still come through it. So she's not exactly – she's not going to be helpless, and she's definitely got more physical power than the other two. And she does. She has stealth and fighting skills as well to keep up with everyone. So I see her as coming out with, a head-to-head confrontation. She's going to be, with Domino. Yeah, she might slip on a rock or something, but then she's still going to be able to recover quickly, and she's going to be pretty much unstoppable. I mean, Domino can blast her back, but she's still going to come right back at her. So she's going to be very difficult to subdue and almost impossible to actually blow apart or kill.
All right.
What do you think, Dan?
I think in Mystique's case, I mean, Mystique's got the advantage in his fact of experience. I think she's been around a lot longer than the two other characters. Nobody even really knows her precise age. Some even say that part of her superpower is that she's ageless. But other than that, I mean, she's worked for essentially every side, right? She's been a bad guy. She's been a good guy. She has a certain moral ambiguity. I think with her shape-shifting, the cool thing about Mystique is a master tactician. And what happens with Mystique is she goes in, she has full confidence, typically because she's always got an exit strategy. Every good strategist has an exit strategy, and I think this boosts confidence. And when somebody knows that there's always a way to get out of something, it makes them that much better of a fighter. In this case, she can use like anything she wants, really. She can either blend into the crowd, or she can use any of her skills of you know, she tracks people before, she's done espionage. She can do any kind of recon without anybody noticing. And while, you know, the two others are fighting, she's doing recon right there, trying to plan out what she needs to do. I think with the strategy and experience and her healing factor, and as far as hand-to-hand and weapons mastery, she's right up on the same level, if not exceeding, both Domino and Lady Deathstrike. I think Lady Deathstrike definitely is the, let's say, the first one to go down, probably, in this case. It'll come down to Domino and Mystique, and it'll be a bit more of a battle of the wits, I think, in that aspect. But I think Mystique's got the experience over her.
So how would she bring Deathstrike down, then?
Well, I don't know. Let's look at every comic book in history where Lady Deathstrike's appeared. So there's many number of ways that Lady Deathstrike can go down. You know, something as simple as you know, if Mystique has planned for this and has noticed that Lady Deathstrike is in the vicinity while still remaining hidden, there's a way for her to sneak off or even acquire, if she doesn't already have it on herself, some sort of an EMP grenade. I mean, there's not much that cybernetics can do against an EMP. All the healing factor in the world aren't going to do much when they shut down your arms. So I just think she can be snuck up on by Mystique. Lady Deathstrike just doesn't have what it takes.
Well, how is she? I mean, I could see Mystique managing to. I mean, Deathstrike's gonna be in hunting mode, but even so, I could see Mystique getting close enough to her to sneak up behind her. But then what? Mystique doesn't normally carry EMP grenades, and I don't know of any of her standard weaponry that would be able to fully disable or subdue Deathstrike. So, meanwhile, she might be able to get a first hit in, but I don't know if she could make a first hit count to put her down for the count, that is. In the meantime, Deathstrike is basically a whirlwind of flying claws, and she's going to heal back from any injury within seconds. So and another thing that I thought of was the Forbidden City. It's a giant tourist attraction, and even though there's not going to be massive computer systems there, there would be one big computer system that Deathstrike could interface with, which is the security system. So she'd have access, mental access to all security cameras, and this being China, there would be a lot of security cameras and alarm systems on which she could remotely access to everyone. So Deathstrike's actually going to have a bird's eye view of the place in her head all the time. She'll be able to see what's happening all over and have tactical advantage, and that she's going to know the lay of the land better than the other two. Whereas Mystique, you're right, is very much a tactician. She's going to be getting the lay of the land, picking her ambush points, and be able to move around fairly unnoticed. But Deathstrike's going to be, she's going to have the up-to-date tactical view where she's going to be seeing, someone skulking around, casing the joint. And all this is going to be playing in her computerized part of her brain while this is going on. So that gives her a big tactical advantage in that she's going to be able to see what's going on around her. she'll also be able to put in messages such as send the police to where Domino pops up, and or send the security guards, that is, and have Domino occupied with security guards attacking her. She can detect who Mystique is camouflaged as. She can throw up a security alert for Mystique's cover identity, saying they're an enemy of the state, that kind of thing. So she can play some mental games and really kind of put the security at the Forbidden City and make it play in her favor as well.
I see Domino and Mystique pulling out big guns and just blasting the crap out of Lady Deathstrike. That's how I see
her
going down.
If I look back, like some recent comic book stories, X-23 pretty much manhandled Lady Deathstrike. And I don't know, X-23 doesn't have the experience that neither Domino nor Mystique have.
Yeah, well, I mean, Mystique has gone toe-to-toe with Wolverine, more so than I think Deathstrike has, so...
Mm-hmm.
Last time I remember that, Wolverine left, thought he stabbed her through the heart, but she shifted her organs.
Right.
So...
Well, I think something that would work against Deathstrike in this fight is her dependence on technology. And when you take a look at somebody like Domino, one of the main things that she often affects and when her own cybernetics, her own body is composed of technology, I think that, you know, hopefully Domino could play a little bit of havoc on somebody like Lady Deathstrike.
Yeah.
So I put this up on Facebook and it was pretty good. Within seconds, we had pretty good conversation going with a bunch of people. A couple of friends of the COC, Michael Guy Hartsburg, he's all over Mystique. He thinks Mystique's the clear winner here. Nick Zamora also believes that Mystique is the winner. He likes Mystique in this one. And then our good buddy Billy Dunleavy jumps in and throws in a vote for Domino.
Oh, interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Very cool. Very, very cool. Well, so I guess we will we'll throw this up on the forums and have an official vote. Do you want to do it that way?
Yeah, I think we should put it on the forums, have an official vote, and then maybe keep a running tally of COC managers basically on who's got, you know, a win loss record.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we'll keep a running tally and just see who can pull it out. I kind of like this format, to tell you the truth. It's sort of there's a little bit less prep that you can do for it.
Yes.
It takes a real, you know, takes some comic knowledge and a little bit of wherewithal as well.
Yeah, because when you mentioned Domino, the first thing I thought of was over Thanksgiving I read some old X-Men issues, and there was the whole sisterhood thing going on in X-Men around 510, issue 510 of Uncanny. And you had Madeline Pryor setting up that whole cabal of the Mastermind girls and Lady Deathstrike and Psylocke against and Domino popped up. I think it was in that book, or maybe it was in the Astonishing X-Men. But she was actually pretty bad in that, or pretty good. I mean, bad isn't good. You know, she was pretty badass in it. So
cool.
I think she got the Mastermind twins, or not? They're not twins, but sisters.
Right.
Yeah, no, I'd be lying though if I didn't say that I'm kicking myself right now about the Mystique thing.
Yeah,
everybody loves Mystique.
Yeah,
I love Mystique. She's a force, man.
It's really that, to me, it's really that, like I mentioned, the exit strategy thing where, you know, like, if you saw Mystique in person, no matter what you would say or do, she would have that gleam in her eyes saying, like, that there's a way she can counter anything you can think of. She's an escape artist, she's a master of espionage, and she's a master tactician. And whatever you throw at her, she'll find a way out of it or a way to beat it.
All I know is that most recently she got bit pretty hard by a shark girl.
Yeah, and
with no experience, she got subdued by a shark girl. That's all I'm gonna say.
Well, subdued. I don't know. That issue was weird, though.
She got subdued. The shark girl was eating her. I mean, that's all I gotta say. The steak was shark food.
Hey, just for our listening audience, we did warn you.
Yes, she was. Yes, I know. The shark girl was eating Mystique. Okay. The other thing I like about the way that we're doing this is that it has a little bit of the feel of the draft, which is always my favorite part of the seasons when we first start. So to do that every week is kind of fun. So
you know what's interesting too is not so much Lady Deathstrike. Well, at least not as far as I know. But one of the things, like if I drafted Mystique or if I drafted Domino, one of their key attributes or one of their key characteristics, especially when they're fighting male fighters, is that sex appeal, right? And they use it, both of them use it often in their books, right? To kind of infiltrate and get to places where most people can't get to and stuff like that, or get people into positions that, you know, put them in a vulnerable position and then strike. When you have three female characters against each other, that kind of flies out the window. You know, that whole element of attack is gone.
Except for one that can change into a sexy man and use his masculine wiles.
Yeah, if Mystique changes into Cable, that'd throw Domino off guard.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. Or Longshot.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting fight to see, Longshot versus Domino, so... All right, well, let's wrap this up. Go ahead, Ian.
Yeah. So thanks to all of our guests. No thanks to Eli, who dropped out of the call and left us because well, I don't know why. Actually, I think he was feeling abused or something.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, but he's gone. So no thanks to Eli, but thanks to Dan, thanks to Tom, thanks to Jeff, and you know, especially thanks to myself because I'm better than everybody else.
That's true.
And of course, thanks to all of our listeners out there for humoring us here at Contest of Champions, especially with our little reboot of the podcast here, as things are a little bit different and new. And, you know, some people might love it. Some people might hate it. Well, we'd love to hear back from you about it. So feel free to tell us what you think of the show by following us on any of the social media platforms that are floating around out there. Follow us on Twitter at COC Podcast. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/COC Podcast. That's so long.
Yeah, it is.
She said.
That's the triple D disclaimer there, ladies and gentlemen. Or comment on this post for this episode on comicattack.net. You can also check us out at comicrelated.com and their forums as well. Or you can go the old-fashioned route and just email us at jeff@comicattack.net or capekiller@yahoo.ca, you know, and you might want to tell us how much you miss the old tournament format. I think that's why Eli dropped off. He's like, yeah, this isn't for me, and he's gone.
Send us a telegram.
Yeah, yeah. Or let us know, you know, some upcoming things that you'd like to see on the show, especially for our fight of the week. You might have some categories that you'd like to see kind of played out with COC peeps.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Don't forget to go to the forum at former.comicattack.com. Is that right? Is that right, Dan?
What's that?
Former.comicattack.com.
No,
No, that's
it's
not right.
It's Comic Attack.
Ah, .former.com.
Correct.
I got it mixed up. Okay, comicattack.former.com. Be sure to go check out those forums and be sure to vote in the comic, in the Contest of Champions thread there, for this fight. So, we record every Sunday night at 9 p.m., and which makes poor Ian miss The Walking Dead every week. So, poor guy. That's what DVRs are for, right?
Well, not this week, not until February.
Well, that's true. Good. That's true. Yeah. So,
I just want a DVR.
Oh, okay. Yeah, or VCRs, I guess. The show is available for download on iTunes and in other various ways. The following Tuesday or Wednesday, I don't know. We'll see when it comes out. Sometime this week. If you're listening to it, then you know you've already got it. So yippee for you. Leave us a review on iTunes and we'll give you a shout out on the show. So please go and do that for us. This is exciting. Next week's category for our fight of the week is characters whose powers are biological in nature.
Interesting.
Characters whose powers are biological. Give us a little definition there, Ian.
Yeah, that's the whole thing, right? I picked that category because I can't think of anybody's characters, anybody's powers who are biological.
Okay.
So that's why I thought I'm like because the first thing that comes to my mind is Poison Ivy, right? Mm-hmm. Or somebody like that. But you know, we're only doing Marvel characters, so okay. I like this category because I'm gonna have to actually do a little bit of research and find a biological character.
Okay, that gives me some ideas. So okay, that's good.
And remember that what we'll do next week is we'll hold a little vote, a little mini vote, based on all the guests that are here. And if your character, you know, doesn't fall within the biological cap, we're going to vote your ass out, and you can't even participate. So don't try and cheat.
Okay. There you go.
There, Fing Fang Foom.
Dan, did you have a question?
Well, yeah, I was just wondering, like, as far as defining biological, but then if I mention some characters, I don't want them to be taken. So yeah, I'm just not going to.
It's a risk there. So
let's hear him.
Fing Fang Foom.
So does it mean their powers are, biological versus like energy based powers, or you mean like biological as in affecting nature?
Yeah, biological as in affecting nature, like more Terra, you know.
Well, see, that's what I was wondering.
Like elemental.
Well, affecting elemental things is one thing, but is that?
Elemental. Different than biological.
Okay.
Biological to me is something that they can do with their body, not necessarily a control of another element.
Okay. This will be good because we'll have some interesting conversation about what biological is. So we may have just one or two characters who are actually fighting because we'll all have voted everybody else out. So.
Because biology is like the study of living things, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And actually, you know what? I've actually got a character right now in mind that I'm going to pick, and it's going to kick the hell out of all your characters.
Yeah, I've got one too, and it might be the same one. So.
You're totally picking my character. You suck.
All right. Well, from all of us at Contest of Champions, we wish you a pleasant whatever time of day that you're listening to this, and we will see you next week.
Yeah, right before Christmas, we'll see
Woo-hoo!
Ho, ho, ho.
Let's go.